So, hey, Peter, how is everything going today?
Doing great, Lee. Really psyched to be wrapping up Psychonauts 2 and looking forward to it coming out so everyone can check it out.
Yeah, I know that's a really highly anticipated game, and to try and get some of that anticipation going, we're going to really talk about the first game today.
Sounds great.
So I thought we'd start off with Tim Schafer, which seemed like a perfect starting point, who you worked alongside at LucasArts for so long. But then there's a big 7-year gap between his work on Grim Fandango and finally Psychonauts. So what was it like to come back and work with him again and work on one of his madcap projects?
Well, you know, actually 5 of those 7 years we were actually working on Psychonauts. So.
Oh, right. Well, there you go then.
There wasn't much of a break. I mean, we both left in the spring of 2000, if I recall correctly. He left a little before I did, and then I left, I believe it was in May of 2000, and we... pretty soon after I left, we, you know, had some conversations about what he was doing, and so I started to look at Psychonauts 1, you know, that summer, I think, pretty soon after I left, and so it was really just a continuation of the way we things had been in our working relationship before. It just kind of happened on our own at that point.
Absolutely. And now I think about it, a 5-year development time absolutely makes sense, because that is a game that is packed with ideas. And of course, to talk about today, music, because it actually has two different officially released soundtracks and kind of two different approaches with the cinematic soundtrack stuff for all the cutscenes and the actual background theme stuff. So I wondered whether one of those two different styles came more naturally to you at the time.
Well, you know, we've always done both. There's always in games there really are kind of two main types of music. There's the gameplay music, which is, you know, accompanies the actual gameplay, and then there's the non-interactive music, the linear music. Is the way I think of it, and that's sort of more like a movie, and that accompanies the cutscenes or the cinematics that get played in between gameplay. And with Tim's games, they're very cinematic, so there are a lot of cinematics, and so that is a really large portion of the score tends to be cinematics. And I think in the case of Psychonauts 1, I can maybe look this up, but I would say probably a third of the game in that case was, or a third of the score was cinematic music. And so that is why we, you know, had, that's why there were the two soundtracks, because they were sort of two different approaches.
Yeah, there's absolutely masses of the cinematic stuff in there. And I wondered exactly what your approach is that is to that behind the scenes. Like, I imagine that the scenes are probably fully edited up with the voice acting and everything before you come to it. But there also might be a chance that your music helps with the editing as well.
That's a great question. That has varied, you know, between projects, from project to project. And sometimes you get, I mean, obviously the preferred situation for the composer, and really actually for everybody, is that the cinematics are completely done by the time they're ready to be scored with music. And by done, I mean the timing is locked, the art is close to done, and the actual voice recordings are edited in, and a good chunk of the sound effects. That's the preferred situation. It doesn't always work out that way. It certainly hasn't worked out that way with Psychonauts 2. With Psychonauts 1, it was, you know, I'm trying to remember how much. I think most of the cutscenes in Psychonauts 1 were actually in that state, at least when I scored them. There weren't a lot of revisions based on, you know, changes to dialogue or changes to the animation or whatever. So it was, in that sense, it was simply a matter of scoring the scenes that, you know, based on what I knew about the characters and the story and the experience of scoring the in-game music, the cutscenes, because they take so much work to do the art and animation, and they require finished, you know, or close to finished dialogue. They're always done last in the process. So that was definitely the case with Psychonauts 1. The cutscenes were scored last. But it was a fairly, actually, as I recall, it was a fairly straightforward process of simply scoring the scenes when they were ready to be scored, and you know, recording some of the live music afterwards. I'm trying to recall whether there were any issues with recording the live music, because recording live music, you have to schedule the live players, and that may or may not fit in with the rest of the schedule, if you know what I mean.
Right.
My recollection, sorry, is that it was a fairly straightforward process, and so it was simply a matter of, you know, scoring the drama that was happening in the scenes. And you did raise an interesting point, which is sometimes there's a back and forth. Sometimes there's a scene, because the way game development goes, it can be a pretty nonlinear process, even to the point of being chaotic. And sometimes scenes will actually get modified. This is pretty rare, but it does happen, where scenes will get modified based on the music, or the music may be all this, and this is much more common. The music may all be done and recorded, and suddenly you have another minute of cutscene that you didn't know you had, and you have to edit music in to fit that. And that's, you know, that's not a desirable situation, I will say, to all you developers out there. Please don't do that to your composer. It's not rare, and you know, we learn how to deal with it, and it can be actually kind of a fun process to try to make that work. In the case of Psychonauts 1, it was you know, like I said, it was pretty straightforward. So there, I don't recall there being any maybe it's the misty the misty passage of time. Maybe it was more chaotic than I remember, but I seem to recall it being pretty straight ahead.
Right. Well, that kind of, you mentioned about the editing and things like that, kind of leads me into what I was going to talk about next, because you also mentioned the live instrumentation. I definitely have questions about that. But I believe that the vast majority of the actual orchestrated stuff is probably sample libraries and synthesized, right?
For Psychonauts 1, I think it's fair to say that the majority of it was sample based, but not the vast majority.
Right.
Yeah, there were Psychonauts 1 had live instruments on pretty much. Let me think about this. I would say a good majority of the tracks had some kind of live instruments. There, and
yeah,
in fact,
absolutely.
The tracks that didn't have any live instruments, I would say, were pretty rare in Psychonauts 1. I would usually try to play something, you know, like the guitar, for example. I would play live, and the guitars. I also brought in Steve Kirk, who's a he now lives up in Seattle, but he is a fantastic musician. Wasn't a fantastic Bay Area musician at the time, and he played a baritone guitar, which is a very special kind of guitar on Psychonauts 1. And then I borrowed his baritone guitar to play some other tracks on this, you know, in the project. But So guitars are certain, obviously all live, and I played live hand drums and live percussion, and then we had a live drum set, which at the time I was living in a little cottage in the Berkeley Hills, and so. I will say a couple of those sessions, maybe the drum session being one of them, were not greatly appreciated by the neighbors. But we had live drums. We had a wonderful clarinetist who played clarinet and bass clarinetist, a guy named Sheldon Brown, who's a fantastic Bay Area musician.
The same player as on Grim Fandango, right?
No, actually, that's a different guy. Hang on a second. I'm going to shut my... I'm hearing some... planes overhead and some traffic outside. I'm just going to shut my door here. Excuse me.
No problem. Yeah, I might have mixed up some of my names, actually, because I know some of the old-school LucasArts guys were brought in.
Yes, absolutely. So Paul von Wageningen, who's no longer with us, played drums on both Grimm and Psychonauts 1. I actually used one of his tracks on Psychonauts 2 as well. That was right. From Psychonauts 1. And Paul Hansen, who's the bassoonist, played on all three projects: Grimm, Psychonauts 1, and Psychonauts 2. Paul's an amazing bassoonist, jazz bassoon player, plays electric bassoon. We used acoustic bassoon for Psychonauts 1, and he played electric on Psychonauts 2. Let me think about some other folks who might have been.
Well, you had Michael Land on bass.
Yeah, definitely. Who else would? There were several. I mean, there was a French horn player, but I believe his name is Doug Hull. I feel like there's someone else. There probably was a trumpet, but I'm not sure about that. That covers a good number of the live players. For example, Dr. Lobato's theme was Paul Hansen playing double tracking to himself. And not as much live playing as I would have preferred, but, you know, we worked with the budget that we had at the time. Double Fine itself was basically working out of literally a garage in the city. I mean, employees drove into the garage, and then they would step up some ladders to work in some lofts that were looking down on the cars. I kid you not. It was definitely sort of a beginning time for all of us going out from Lucas and trying something on our own. It was a very transformational time for Tim, in that way. We worked with what we had, and we made the very best of it, and it was a really a great project to work on.
And there are some really, really wonderful sounds on there. Like, to go right back to the start of the game, theme like Whispering Rock. I believe that guitar twang, that amazing guitar twang, that really kind of goes throughout all of Psychonauts. That is the baritone guitar, if I'm not wrong?
There are two guitars. Whispering Rock is the baritone, yes. There are some others, though, like, for instance, the campground, the nighttime music at the campground. That's right. That's my Strat tuned down low, I think. And then there's baritone guitar accompaniment.
I was kind of ashamed of myself because I'm a guitarist and a bass player and have been for years, but the whole baritone guitar thing was kind of a new term to me. So I kind of wanted to hear it from you. What exactly is the difference here?
It's not a common instrument, but it's very much... I believe it's tuned down a fourth, if I remember right, from a regular guitar.
Right.
And so that you have a low B rather than a low E. But other than that, it's relatively speaking, it's the same tuning. It just is a quite a bit lower. It's like really sort of a a mean between an electric guitar and an electric bass. And in terms of where its pitch is, the tonality of it is very much guitarish and not bassish, if that's a word. And it was really popularized as far as I know in the 60s with some of the sort of cowboy and spy movies. So you'll hear baritone guitar in pretty sure you'll hear baritone guitar, don't quote me on this, in some Ennio Morricone scores.
Right, and I think it might have been popping up in some of those early sci-fis as well, like you were referencing in the Milkman level.
Yeah, and if not, you know, I'd love to be able to say in this particular movie or that particular movie there was a Barry guitar. I don't have that at my fingertips, but I know that sound was very very common, sort of a way to sort of get across machismo, essentially, in some of those sort of, you know, spy movies and cowboy movies of the mid 60s, early 70s, or even early 60s. Yeah.
Well, actually, now we're talking about that kind of film theme inspiration stuff, I did definitely want to come to the Milkman conspiracy and the great sound you've got on that level, incorporating a kind of... Am I wrong in thinking that's a theremin?
It is an imitation of a theremin. It is actually it's a custom patch that I made on the Kurzweil K2000, which I still have my... In fact, funny you mentioned that, because I just gave my K2000 to my 13-year-old son, who's really getting into sort of classic 80s and 90s synth sounds, and he's enjoying getting into such classic sounds as the Batman strings that are on that.
Right.
That are on that. But yeah, that was a custom patch that I made on the K2000. I can't remember what it's based on, but I'll tell you this. I still have a floppy disk that has that patch and a number of others that I keep in a special place that I can, so I can load it into the K2000 whenever I fire it up. It's, you know, as long as the floppy disk drive works and my few remaining floppy disks don't die, I have my special theremin sound should I need it.
You see, I was actually hoping that it was a patch, because I've never actually encountered a theremin patch, and I imagine it's a really difficult thing to do with each note having to connect so fluidly into the next and how expressive of an instrument it is. So, like, how difficult was it to put that together?
Well, the trick there, that's a great detail. Yeah, the trick there with the K2000 is a very it's got a very generous portamento, and that's what you're talking about, which is basically a slur from one note. When you play one note and then you play the next note while the first note is still playing, the synthesizer will execute a very smooth ooh, like suppose you play bum bum, and then if you play ooh, and then you hit the note ooh, it'll go up like that.
Oh man! That
portamento feature on is very you know, it's got a nice thick or long portamento on the K2000, but it's in terms of for folks who have actually, you know, delved a little bit into digital signal processing. I myself was once a software engineer for Lexicon. Do you know what Lexicon is? They made effects boxes for musicians.
Yeah, yeah. I seem to remember us talking about this in a past interview, actually.
They still are in business, actually. I think they're... Mm-hmm. But a lot of those classic effects boxes are still in big studios. I just was at Skywalker recently, and there were some Lexicon boxes there still that are just, you know, they use every day because they're awesome. Skywalker being Skywalker Sound, which is over the hill from me here. But if you know a little bit about digital signal processing for audio, It is a bit of a trick to make a pitch change smoothly, and you end up doing what amount to little splices in the audio and the code. And so and that is hard to do perfectly, and they're different. Each algorithm has its own strong points and weak points. In the case of the K2000, the portamento effect would sometimes glitch. You can hear it sometimes, a little pop from going from one note to another, and sort of avoiding those pops was a matter of you had to get a little creative about when you did the note transition, how you performed it, and what else was playing at the same time to maybe cover it up. So yeah, there were some definitely some tricks I had to play to get that to work, but I was really very happy with that sound, and it definitely is, I think of that as the milkman thing. It evokes the UFO paranoia is too strong a word, because we've just learned that they're real. but it reflects the sort of fascination with UFOs and in 50s movies movies like The Day the Earth Stood Still, right, which has that's a famous Bernard Herrmann score that uses a theremin that really kind of put that instrument on the map, and that's really kind of what I was trying to pay homage to.
And I love all these extra details that seem almost hidden behind the music, should you choose to see them. And one of my favourites is during the Waterloo World sequence. You've got references to the French National Anthem and the 1812 Overture. I did a little research, which I didn't realise this in the past, but it turns out that that piece was written about a Russian victory over Napoleonic forces. And that's pretty much exactly what's going on in the game there, is a Napoleonic raid on someone's mind, Fred in this case. So, like, that's such a brilliant idea, and where does that come from? Is it kind of you and Tim talking, or just purely you?
In my youth orchestra in high school, we played the 1812 Overture. And which is a really, and there's also a tradition in Boston. I went to school in Boston after high school, but there's a tradition in Boston of playing the 1812 Overture on the 4th of July, and John Williams would always conduct the Boston Pops. Playing that piece, which I always thought was funny because it's the 4th of July, and those days, I'm not a spring chicken, and those days it was the Cold War. And here we are playing the Russian national anthem. although it is the Tsarist Russian national anthem, right? But that's all come back now. They play that old I'm pretty sure they play that old anthem. The bum 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 bum. I think that is again Russia's national anthem. Some things don't change for long. Yes, that was totally intentional, and it had to do with I love that piece and had played it when I was a kid. And Napoleon, if you say Napoleon and music, I'm going to think of two things. Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, which was originally dedicated to Napoleon before he decided to invade Germany or Austria or whatever. And then he changed the dedication. And then, of course, the War of 1812, the 1812 Overture, is just a cool piece. But that's spot on. In terms of the discussion with Tim, I do get that question a lot. What's it like to work with Tim? And Tim really leads kind of by example and inspiration, and not so much by directive. So my experience with him has always been, in the beginning of a project, we might have some conversations about we might have some conversations about general music aesthetic, the types of things that, you know, he's going to be exploring in the game. In the case of Psychonauts, he sent me some actual Roma music, gypsy music. Gypsy is not really a term we use anymore, but actual traditional music from various Roma bands, and that had been actually, it was, strangely enough, I think it had been on Johnny Depp's playlist or something, and then Rolling Stone or something like that. Anyway, so I listened to the real deal, you might say, and that sort of informed pieces like the Meat Circus, because there's some sense that Raz's family are wandering nomads who might come from a similar tradition, and so I listened to this music that Tim gave me, and I also would go through a process where I would come up with the themes for the game, and we still do this. We did this with Psychonauts 2 in a more updated version, but in those days I had a handheld cassette player, which I used in Grim Fandango as well, and I just run the thing while I'm playing at the piano and humming the theme. So and then I would dump it into my computer and send it to Tim as an MP3, and MP3s had just been invented for Psychonauts 1. That was convenient. I would send this audio recording of me just singing the theme, and I still have those somewhere. And then he would, you know, give feedback, and from there it was pretty much I just run with it. I get very, very little, hands-on guidance from Tim during a project. It's once in a while he'll say, you know, I really need such and such at such and such a spot, or really, and I'm once in a blue moon, he'll say, oh, you know, this isn't working for me. I had such and such in mind, for this particular piece. I don't know. I don't think there were any of that latter case in Psychonauts, but that was a long time ago. So perhaps I'm forgetting.
And how was it to work with Eric Walpaugh as well, who then, of course, went on to do amazing things with Valve?
I'm mostly for Psychonauts. I did mostly work with Tim, and also, well, there were different, you know, there were different business people, you know, like Carolyn Esmerdoc being the one at the. Near the end, I think, of that process, I don't recall having a whole lot of interactions with Eric directly. It was mostly just, I'm trying to remember now.
It is going back 16 years.
Yeah, the musician kind of, especially when you're independent and you're not in house, you have a contact at the company. Where you send the music to, and there's a lot of interaction there, and not a lot of interaction with other members of the company, unless you come in and, you know, have meetings and sync up, as it were, to sort of get everybody's vision. Definitely. Double Fine is, and when I say Tim leads by example, my experience as a sort of an inside outsider, if you will, is that there's a lot of collaboration, a lot of sort of communal effort that goes into every Double Fine game, which I think is why one reason they have tend to have employees that stay there longer than pretty much any other company I've heard of in this business. And there's kind of an organic process that happens that, you know, once it's done, it's kind of hard to put your finger on what happened.
Right. Because I definitely get that sense with Psychonauts that everything's just so completely, fully realized and locked in together. The art, the writing, the humor, the music.
It is. And a tremendous amount of attention to detail.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the meat circus as well earlier, which I definitely can't let pass because I know that's absolutely infamous among fans for the way it kicked up difficulty right at the end. But when we come to the actual theme itself, that struck me as having like a kind of massive live instrumentation. Like there was a clarinet going on, I think, and a violin and some guitars too. And was there any sense of like, this is the last level, I have to pull out all the stops here?
Are you talking about the meat circus music, that piece, or are you talking about the main theme, which is which in sort of the Psychonauts 1, it kind of morphs into that other piece that I just hummed.
Yeah, no, the much faster,
the circusy one. Yeah,
yeah, definitely.
So that was and that tied right into the, I thought of that as sort of the signature Raz music, really, in some ways. Right. And I knew that we were going to have that big sort of finale. And yes, the drums are live in that. The clarinet, Sheldon Brown's awesome clarinet playing is live. I play the violin. Trying to think of who else might be... there might have been some kind of, no, I think that might be it. I was going to say there might have been some kind of trombone or something, but I don't think so. There's a lot of samples there that I wish were real, but we had as much live, as many live players as we could on that. And yeah, that, was, very, you know, besides the traditional music, I of course had Danny Elfman in mind. There's a for that and a couple of other cues in the game, but yeah, that's I'm pretty happy with that piece.
Yeah, and it reflects again that there are so many different genres throughout this game. For example, go to Mia's dance party, and you've just got some like really cool disco going on. And with all of that going on in one game, how easy is it for you to get into the headspace of a particular genre? Like you mentioned doing research with the Roma stuff and everything.
Well, Mia's Dance Party actually ended up being not my piece, but that said, that was done by someone in the company who was a little closer to that genre than I was. But I do pride myself in having a broad palette, and the thing I always say is when some people say they like all kinds of music, they mean everything from Led Zeppelin to AC/DC. And when I say I like all kinds of music, I really mean it. I mean, there are very, very, very few genres that I don't actually just love. And I mean, we're talking Palestrina, liturgical music to Ma Rainey. And if you know who Ma Rainey was, Netflix just did a thing about her. I really like to explore all these different types of music, because I think we live in a world where things aren't so, I guess I shouldn't say they aren't so divided, because we all know things are divided these days, but everyone has access to everything now in a way that they didn't when I was even like a young person. And my kids are just as fluent with Benny Goodman as they are with Billie Eilish. And that's not the way it was when I was a kid. And so I think given that we, you know, do live in that kind of a world in which music is more of a uniter than it is a divider, where a lot of different folks like a lot of different kinds of music. And so that's the way I like to compose. I don't like to think of myself as a jazz composer or a classical composer or a rock composer. I'm just a composer. And
this kind of brings me to a point that I kind of picked up through Psychonauts, which was that games could give a lot of opportunities to a composer to punch down to the audience. An example of that would be something like Waterloo World. You could just kind of do some accordion-y kind of stuff, like really cliched, even potentially offensive French stuff.
The beret and the cigarette sort of thing.
absolutely. There's a lot of opportunities for that in games, but it seems that in Psychonauts, like at every opportunity, you punch up rather than down and do something that is like really strongly inspired by something interesting or genuine source material.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And, you know, I also appreciate the good cliche every so often. It kind of depends on the type of humor that you're dealing with. But Psychonauts is this kind of delicate sort of humor where you know, Raz is so deadly serious about what he's doing, and yet there's humor to it, and so you want to show appreciation for the. I'm kind of speaking for Tim here, but I think there's an element of the, not quite the innocence, but the magical world of childhood. And as you're just leaving childhood and entering the world around you, my kids are, you know, I've got a preteen and a teenager right now, and I guess they're both technically teenagers since the young one's 13. You know, it is a time where your eyes are opening up to the world, and I think Psychonauts is and there's funny things about it, you know, about that time in life. It's a lot of people, including myself, look back on that time of life with embarrassment. but there is something special about a time where you still have some of the innocence of youth, but you're learning about the big world at the same time. And so there are things that you find to be very important and very serious that later on you're not maybe going to find so important and so serious. The idea is to sort of honor that earnestness. So you wouldn't want to do that by being too burlesque about it, right?
Yeah.
So I appreciate that comment. Thank you. That's a nice observation.
No, I think that was another thing I noticed was that the music didn't often fall into being too goofy or wacky, even though things are really like, it's genuinely very, very funny game and quite silly too, that kind of style. But your music, again, it's, as I say, kind of punches up. And I think it might have been me and you in the past. I've done a lot of interviews who discussed the idea of putting a hat on a hat. So it's like the music doesn't need to be goofy.
Right. You know, and I think where some of that came from is actually my work, you know, different company and different title, but my work with Dev Madden on Sly Cooper. He would always say that, you know, let if there's going to be a gag, let the gag be the gag and have the music be the straight man. It's much funnier.
So I remember Mike Muraski saying the same thing about Portal, that he tried doing some silly things, but it just didn't work.
Right. And I do, you know, and I do appreciate, I'm a huge fan of Carl Stalling, which is the opposite approach. And a lot of my music is informed by Carl Stalling, for those of you out there who don't know, is the fellow who wrote all the music for the Looney Tunes. So all the Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner music. And that's very much on the nose, slapstick burlesque humor musically. That's just, and so it's hard for me not to be, that was a huge influence on me growing up through Saturday morning cartoons, and it's hard for me not to be influenced by that. But that said, what I really took out of that was sort of the whimsical nature of things, as opposed to the sort of what's the word I want? The ridicule's too strong a term, but you know, the burlesque, the exaggerated slapstick humor is something that I try to avoid unless it's really, really called for.
Right. And it was something that I particularly picked up in the Black Velvetopia level, where you're playing with all these kind of Spanish kind of tropes. But at the same time, there was something very Psychonauts about it. And I'm not sure I could entirely put my finger on it. So I wanted to put that to you, whether you could categorize the Psychonauts sound that's underneath there.
Jeez, yeah, that is kind of a... That was hard because I had to play those hand drums myself. And I am a slightly better hand drum player now than I was then. But, what is it about that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to put my finger on it either. I know what you're talking about. It's definitely, you know, this sort of bullfight, cliche chords, and
yeah, like that was the impression I got. Like it did the cliche chords a little bit, and then it quickly went off into Psychonauts territory.
I do get kind of restless harmonically, so I would have to go somewhere that wasn't those places. Like I don't know how else to put it. I think the things that make that sound maybe a little bit different are the themes that are quite definitely Psychonauts and not really traditional sounding themes or traditional, you know, Spanish folk sounding themes. That's one thing. And although they're done in that kind of style, with that kind of phrasing. Then there's also the bassoon counter melody, which is very, very much kind of Psychonauts / Grim Fandango-y.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. Yeah.
And then as you mentioned, there definitely went to some harmonic places that, in like real Spanish music, that wouldn't, or music from the Mediterranean, that would not be terribly surprising. Like a composer like Mikis Theodorakis comes to mind. He's a Greek composer, but it's not something that you're going to hear right away in this sort of world of tropes. So yeah, I guess I have an instinct about trying to avoid that sort of thing.
Well, I'm glad that you've mentioned the themes as well, because that's a big part of the score, and they're kind of weaved in all over the place, all over different kinds of tracks. So how early do they come in the process for you? Do you make sure you've got the themes established like before you get to work on the meat of the pieces? Or
I do like to have the themes nailed down before I'm getting into it. I mean, not all projects allow for that. Different projects have different, different teams have different styles of working. But in general, I do, if it's at all possible, I try to have the themes, the actual melodies worked out, ahead of time, so that, you know, I know what my, because the themes are the scaffolds. They're, to me, they are the most important thing about the score. You need to have memorable melodies. And so I mean, for Grim Fandango, there was a period of at least 6 months where that's all I was doing, was right. Themes. And Psychonauts, it was pretty close to the same. There was a long time where I was sending themes to Tim. And it's not intensive work. I wouldn't say that was 6 months of work. It was probably more like a week of work, if that, spread out over those 6 months. But... It's necessary to get perspective and to sort of tap into the muse, as it were. I find that it is helpful to spread that over a good long time. You get better results if you do it that way. So if there's the opportunity to do that in a project, if there's the opportunity to come in early enough so that there's a time to woodshed, then that's always a good thing, I think. And it's nice to be able to have that opportunity to develop those things over a period of time.
Yeah, because it gives a project like Psychonauts from the very beginning to the end of this game, no matter all the different crazy directions it goes into, this really amazing coherence. And not just that, but something that can be followed on into sequels as well, like Psychonauts 2. But I also wanted to ask a couple of questions about Rhombus of Ruin as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because, well, for a start, that has that excellent main theme. So I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit about writing it alongside Tim, who wrote the lyrics, I believe, and that amazing performance from Kim Nally as well.
So the way that worked, yeah, Kim did an amazing job. The way that worked, and the way I've done several songs with Tim, starting with the Rusty Anchor song, and I believe that was the first song I did with him in Grim Fandango. It's funny because it's very traditional the way we work, i.e. he hands me the lyrics, I get them in an email, I sit down and look at them, and I write a tune. it's totally Rodgers and Hammerstein. It is not Lennon and McCartney.
Right.
So the way the Rhombus of Ruin worked, and sometimes I will have to come back. In that case, I believe I did have to come back to Tim and say, you know, there's an awful lot of verses here. We're going to have to, in order to make this work in a 2.5 minute song, we're going to have to, you know, pare it down a little bit. But other than that, it's other than that level of editing of saying, you know, can we consolidate these two verses into one, or can we lose this? That's also, that happened, by the way, with the Cabbage Boy song in Brutal Legend. It's just, I am scoring Tim's poem. And so, with the Rhombus of Ruin, obviously I had guidance, you know, he was thinking of the James Bond themes. So that was really the Rhombus of Ruin song is kind of a Goldfinger parody, and that's what Kim was going for in the singing, and the sort of the big orchestral sound in that song was based on sort of the Goldfinger sound, but it was kind of updated to be more of a 21st century deconstructionist version of that, if you will. I actually took recordings from of the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra from Broken Age, and right. that is the orchestra in the Rhombus of Ruin song.
Well, since that's only a VR title, then any of my listeners out there who don't have VR helmets should go out and listen to this. It's such a badass tune.
Thanks. Yeah, that's. I mean, and we recorded Kim at Skywalker Ranch to do that, and it was just a really fun experience to lay down the tracks, and it was fun for me to put all the pieces together, you know, to make what we finally. What finally went in the game. And I think there might be a little taste of that song in Psychonauts 2 too. I'm not sure how that's gone down in the final version.
You're flying so high over cities of gold, but in your mind's eye, something evil takes hold. Call from a stranger, you whisper a name, dive into danger.
But otherwise, since I've mentioned it is a VR game, and you're kind of seeing through Raz's eyes through most of the game, as well as various other people, of course. But do you think that level of immersion that comes with VR kind of changes the philosophy of video game music, because one thing I noticed is that there was very little original music in there, in the sense of there were long gameplay sections with no music whatsoever until something came from a source. Kind of, there was a lot of source music in there, such as like the radio and the school bus and things like that. I wondered whether you think that might be the way things go as things become more VR based and more immersive.
I think it's going to depend a little bit on the particular game. I think that you know, what to do with music in VR is, I think, a subject that is still being explored. Because it does, I mean, to me, it goes back to when I was a kid and I would watch Mission Impossible. And then later on, I might, you know, when I was playing in the basement, it gets hot in Kansas. I lived in Kansas at the time. And so everybody's got a basement and an air conditioner. So you got a lot of time in the heat of the day to retreat from the sun and have imaginary play. And in my case, the imaginary play always had a soundtrack. I was, you know, I was humming the Mission Impossible music while I was pretending to be a spy or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of kids go through that, or maybe the kids who grow up to compose music for picture go through this, where it's like you've always got to have a soundtrack going when you're pretending. And, you know, doon, 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 you know, you're doing that. Yeah. But the question is, when you're not in that imaginary, let me say that somewhat differently. The question is, when you're really trying to simulate or reconstruct or construct an imaginary world like that that's completely immersive, when you're pretending, the music comes from your head or maybe from your own mouth because you're singing it. But where does it come from in virtual reality? Yeah. Where does that underscore? I mean, we all know where the radio music comes from. It comes from the radio. We all know where the stereo or the iPod music or whatever comes from. It comes from the stereo or the iPod. But where does that underscore come from? Where is the band? Does it move in space when you move in space? It's a real, I think that's a question that is still, I'm not saying it's necessarily an unsolved problem, but I think it's still a question that you deal with when you're doing VR, and I think there's probably going to be, continue to be interesting answers to that question.
Absolutely. It seemed in Rhombus of Ruin that a lot of the time original music was saved for these big moments, like a big boss battle or a huge cinematic moment, whereas actually, like, the gameplay moments, as I say, were left quite silent outside for source stuff.
Yes, that's right, and I think that was intentional, and it was also it also reflected the scope of the project. It was a smaller sort of a project, but I think it was artistically intentional as well, because it was about that title is about your immersion in that world. So music's going to have a little bit of a different role. But I, you know, in terms of the other question that you asked about, well, what does that mean for the future? I have no idea. I think it really depends on the type of game, on the type of reality that you have, because the function of music is to enhance the emotion, and it's to help guide you or inspire you or remind you of what the drama is, what the emotion is in a situation. And I don't think that's ever going to go away, but it may change depending on the type of experience you're having.
Absolutely. I'm just fascinated to see the way it's going to evolve with VR, really. I think it presents some really interesting, as you say, questions and answers to be found.
Right.
Well, the last question I had, since we are running out of time, is since, again, there was a big year's gap between Psychonauts and Psychonauts Rhombus of Ruin, are you glad to see this game be getting the reception that it kind of deserves? Because it didn't sell very well at first and finally is getting its love through various other platforms and remasters and stuff and such.
Oh, of course, you know, and you know, it really is true that sometimes it takes a while for something to catch on, you know, or to be appreciated. It doesn't, you know, we're in this world of where, you know, the first 48 hours of a release of something are like some incredible portion of the attention and even sales that it gets. It's crazy. So it's nice to see, you know, when something has a little more staying power or gets revisited that way. I think that's awesome.
Absolutely. And Psychonauts is such an incredible, vivid world. It really does deserve to be shared and continue on. Hopefully Psychonauts 2 won't be the end.
Right on.
Okay, Pete. Well, hopefully we'll speak again in the future about Psychonauts 2, but we'll leave that for the big release.
Right. Well, I do look forward to it, Lee.
Right, well, thank you very much for speaking to me today, Peter.
Yeah, well, it's my great pleasure, and yes, I do look forward to our next conversation about this. There's going to be a lot to talk about.